troubling memories are often storehouses of pain and hurt. Seated deep within our minds, they can seem impossible to dislodge. Our guest today, clinical psychologist Dr. Carla Manley, offers 5 simple steps to safely face our fearful memories, learn from them, and successfully break free. Carla says that fear, instead of denying it, we need to face it and heed its inner voice. Her method helps us detach from fear and learn from it. It teaches us how to separate constructive from destructive fear and guides us in how to find the meaning in our fears and use it to our benefit. Dr. Carla is a practicing clinical psychologist based in Sonoma County, California, and a recognized authority on fear and fear-based disorders such as traumatic fear, anxiety, and depression. She works with individuals and groups to improve personal growth, relationship connection, and increased life fulfillment. Her highly personalized approach focuses on utilizing transformational fear in the self-growth and healing process. She combines clinical knowledge with a holistic body-mind-spirit approach, integrating yoga and meditation practices into her therapeutic work. And it's a pleasure for us to have on the show today, Dr. Carla. Dr. Carla, you there?
Yes. Oh, yes, I'm here. Hello. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So, you know, fear is a terrible problem. And if you are out hiking and you see a rattlesnake a foot in front of you, it's okay to have fear. But a lot of times, the fear is irrational and only serves to hurt us. And I want you to tell our audience why you wrote a book on fear.
Thank you for that great introduction, because it gets to the heart of the matter. Many people think of fear as being one entity, the type of fear, as you said, that is a good fear, that when we see that rattlesnake, we know to steer clear, go in the opposite direction. However, there's another type of fear that is irrational fear, a type of fear that gets into our brains and our bodies, often from a very early age. And so we often live our lives with these unconscious fears. And where do these fears come from? Most of them are very irrational and destructive and come from a place, often in early childhood, where we are given a message by a parent, caregiver, or teacher, something that tells us we're defective, we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, that we are too thin, too fat, too short, too tall, something, right? And so that fear, even if we're not aware that it's there, it often drives us throughout the rest of our lives, affecting our decisions. And so that is the destructive nature of fear. And as we learn to listen to the fear, to learn to acknowledge it, not run from it, not overcome it, not push it away into some compartment in the brain, but when we learn to listen to it, to actually make it our friend, to investigate it and even embrace it, that's where the learning comes from, and that's where the growth comes from.
So, an important point, I think, that you talked about there is that you get fear from things that you learn as you're growing up, and generally it's from negative things that you learn. And this contributes to a low self-esteem, and a low self-esteem is the cause of addiction, and that's what I work with, is 30 different kinds of addiction. And why do you have a low self-esteem? Well, a part of it is what you heard when you are growing up, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And actually, in my book, in Joy from Fear, I spend a great deal of time. I volunteer at a drug and alcohol rehab center once a week, and I've really come to appreciate that part of the of human nature, where addictions are fed by low self-esteem, and many people don't understand the difference between self-esteem and self-confidence. And so I discuss that and help clarify that. In fact, I saw something this morning where somebody was describing self-esteem as though it were self-confidence. And it's so important to know the difference, and that self-confidence is generally, and I don't know, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but self-confidence I see as generally a skill in a certain area, a certain accomplishment, possibly a certain quality we have, such as looks or you know, physical strength, and that self-esteem is something completely different. Self-esteem is something that we earn in life, and often that child's budding self-esteem is affected by parents' dismissiveness or neglect or overt abuse. And so that child grows up not knowing who they are on the inside. They might not have a strong moral compass, strong values, and thus might not know what their personal power is, their strengths, and being able to face both their strengths and their weaknesses, and then work to, you know, fine-tune and heal the weaknesses that can be healed. And so I agree with you that that does feed into addiction, because then addiction is a way of self-soothing, albeit very temporary self-soothing, to make that hurt of the poor self-esteem feel less painful.
It's interesting. I went to a meetup group, and the title was Confidence, about 2 or 3 days ago. And we discussed in that group the difference between confidence and self-esteem. And what I hear you saying is that you can be confident in one area of your life, like your skill as a mechanic, for example. But in your total life, you have a low self-esteem. You don't value yourself enough as a human being, and you don't know your relative position in the universe. And so is that causes you to take up with addictions, whereas you could be confident in some aspects of your life, and still have a low self-esteem. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely, and one of the best ways I describe it, because I'll work with someone and they'll say, but my neighbor, I don't understand why she's, you know, a pill popper, an alcoholic. She's so confident. She's beautiful. She drives a fancy car, and her husband is, you know, this and that. And I'm saying, wait a second. That she may be confident in her looks, which are fleeting, right? She may be confident and appear very pushy and buoyant and all of those things, but the self-esteem is missing. The self-esteem. And also, as you know, with addiction often comes a lot of patterns of lying and deceit and not being true to the self or to others. And that, too, of course, is a hallmark of low self-esteem.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to hear you say that you can be confident and yet still have a low self-esteem, because with my patients over the years, I've found that that certainly is the case, and you don't want to confuse those two entities too much.
I agree.
Okay, so this book is on constructive fear versus destructive fear, and I imagine that my question pertains to destructive fear. How does fear hold you back in life?
Let's stick maybe with our theme of addiction and recovery. And so where I see this at work is somebody who believes at a very core level that they are not good enough, that perhaps a parent instilled in them, you know, at a very early age, that everything you touch will be a mess, that you are not as good as I am, that you are always going to fail, you know, whatever the messages are. So that child And of course, that child can't tell the outside world. The child will want to cover that up as best as possible and hide, and therefore the shame blossoms and grows and festers inside of that person. And, you know, like a very difficult weed, right? And it just grows. And so that's the destructive fear, that pernicious weed, that message that constantly says, you aren't good enough. Everybody's going to find out. Try harder, work harder, put up a better shield. And it's very tiring. And then you drink or use pills or oversex or overshop or do this or that so that you're distracted from that terrible, constant inner voice that's telling you you're a fraud. Somebody's going to figure it out. And so with that message, and that is all destructive fear at work, because if that person were sitting before me and you know with your clients, as you start teasing all of this apart and facing those messages and facing the absolute falsity of those messages, that particularly for those who believe in a higher power and a divine, right, there is that comfort in knowing that you are always loved. You are always appreciated. With all of your strengths, your weaknesses, your courages, your frailties, you are a good and divine soul. And now that's one thing for a person to hear, but for a person to start to believe that and then take actions in life that build self-esteem, to speak truth, to live one's truth, that is how we build self-esteem, one step at a time. And that is how we face and work with the destructive fear.
Carla, so some fears are more prominent than other fears. Do you have an idea of what are some of the most prominent fears that listeners today would have?
Yes, I think that really when at the very core of all of us is a desire to be loved, a desire to feel safe, loved, respected. Because if we are not safe on a very primitive level, if we are not loved, we are the sheep that's cast out of the herd and eaten by the wolf, right? So on a very primitive, you know, lizard brain level, we need to be accepted, loved, safe. And so I think many of our fears come from that place. We become afraid of being rejected. We become afraid of being dismissed, unwanted, and then we become afraid of being vulnerable, because when we don't believe that we are a good person or that we are worthy or lovable, then we are afraid to be vulnerable. We are afraid to open our hearts and souls to the world, and we have a very judgmental world out there, right? And we are afraid that that world will judge us harshly and judge us for our weaknesses and our truths. And if we are judged too harshly or believe we are being judged too harshly, then we retract and we close down because we are afraid of being an outcast from the group.
So you said that one of the fears that hits most of us is the fear of not being loved. Now, I want to take that one step farther and say that many people have somebody that says, I love you. However, most people do not have even one person who says, I love you no matter what. This love that I have for you is not based on anything that you do or don't do. It's just an unconditional love. And I think that everybody wants or needs to have at least one relationship where they can feel unconditionally loved.
And I completely agree with you, and you've hit one of my pet peeves, where we use the word love. As you know, other cultures, other languages may have many words for love, and in our language, in the English language, we tend to stick to one word. Sometimes we'll say platonic love or romantic love, but we have this one way of seeing love. And so what I tend to think in response to what you've said is that let's first understand what it means to really love someone. And that means to have good boundaries, to be respectful, to have a friendship, to treat somebody with integrity, loyalty, respect. And then from that place, you can build the absolute acceptance for everything that somebody is, strengths and weaknesses, because you have the honesty. You know who they are, they know who you are, and you have that honesty between you. And then from that place, because some people confuse, they think, oh, but if I love you unconditionally, that means I have to let you beat me. That means I have to let you, you know, steal my car or, you know, hurt my dog. And no, true and unconditional love also has boundaries and says, wait a second, this is not good for you or for me. This is not respectful. So I agree with you that to have, we often do not have that kind of unconditional love because we don't have those parameters. We don't realize that that unconditional love does have boundaries and still love. May not like the person's actions and may need to have very strong boundaries with the person, but the love can still be there.
Well, I would just like to say that for anyone who's listening today who feels, I don't have a single relationship where I have unconditional love, I can tell you that you do, you just don't know it. And that relationship is your relationship with the creator of the universe who loves you unconditionally regardless of what you do. And if you think about that and go study about that and everything, that will give you some comfort.
And I agree with you, Wynn, 100%, which is why I said, you know, earlier, for the people who have a connection to their divine, that having that higher power who is always there, who loves you, does not fail you, is with you through thick and thin, and you knowing that and believing in that and trusting that you are part of that original light, that creative light, and that is unconditional love. And we can only hope on this plane to emulate that in our relationships.
Absolutely. Okay, so your book is called Joy from Fear. So let's talk about joy. Contrast for me the difference between joy and happiness?
I love that question, and here's why. I think in our culture, many cultures, we confuse the ideas of pleasure, happiness, and joy. We use them interchangeably often. And pleasure, to me, is a very brief and fleeting physical state. Happiness often relies on external elements. You make me happy, that book makes me happy, that pizza makes me happy, that sort of thing. Whereas joy is something that I see as one of the five basic emotions, and that joy is a quality that is always within us, a quality that we have most likely, you know, when we're fetuses in that, you know, that state inside the womb, where all is well, and that once we are born, and this is how I like to explain it to people, it's as though we are born with this votive candle of clear, beautiful, translucent light, and this little glass votive of our joy that's always there. As life, we encounter harsh experiences and negativity and hurt, that what we end up doing is getting a lot of soot built up. A lot of soot built up around that little candle votive, around the glass votive. And so depression sets in and anxiety sets in and we don't see or feel our light anymore. But all we need to do is learn how to clear the soot off by being kind and gentle and tender and looking at our emotions and looking at our actions. And all of that clears the soot and allows us to feel that steady, constant light of what I believe is one of our true states, that state of joy that is not dependent on whether or not we get our way or whether or not the sun's out. It's just that state of feeling, in my case, you know, often feeling that divine connection, that I'm just this one tiny little particle of something so much more, but that I am connected and interconnected, and that my life matters, and that your life matters, and that what we do matters. That gives me joy. That's available for all of us.
Yeah. So, in my backstory, which I won't go into here, you can buy my book, Freedom from Addiction 3, on Amazon if you want to read it. There was a time in my life when I was reduced to 13 objects, and that included all my clothes, my Bible, 13 things. That's all I had in life. And yet, because I was fulfilling my purpose for the Creator, I was more joyous and happy than I was earlier when I was making $50,000 a month and had everything material that I could have. Does that sound believable to you?
Absolutely. Absolutely believable, because that is joy. Joy does not, so many people confuse having money with being joyful, yet, or having, you know, material possessions. Yet, the more possessions we have, as you know, the happiness curve, what they call the happiness curve, often the more money we have does not contribute to how we feel in life, whether it's joy or happy. And so it makes perfect sense that your 13 possessions, with that level of simplicity and doing what you felt you wanted to do, that passion, that makes sense to me.
Well, now, another one of our people who gets quoted a lot is Marianne Williamson. You know her?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, I'm just going from memory here, but correct me if I'm wrong. But I believe she said once that there are only two emotions, and those emotions are love and fear. Was that right, or did I miss something?
I don't know if that's not, you know, one of my favorite quotes of hers is a different one, the one about your internal light and living your light so that others can live and shine and with their light as radiant as well. But the two emotions, love and fear, I've heard that in a variety of situations, so I don't, you know where it emanated. But I can say that I don't really agree with it.
Okay.
Because I've done and here's why. I think on a primitive level, which is why I choose the five emotion model that I do, and I've done, in fact, my book goes into that, where I really tried to look at the different models. Some are as few as four, and some are as high as, you know, in the 20s of the different emotions. But the one I like to stick with has joy, anger, fear, disgust, and sadness. And that model rings very true to me. And here's why. Because I think the model of love on one pole and fear on the other pole simply does not allow for, let's think of sadness. Sadness is neither love nor fear. Sadness is sadness. Disgust, which is, you know, often thought as one of the primitive emotions, that's not really love or fear. It comes from that place, that visceral place of, ugh, you know, I ate a bad mushroom. Ugh, this doesn't feel right. And so, and then anger. I think anger sometimes arises from fear, often arises from fear. But I also think anger has a different edge to it often that doesn't have something to do with love or fear. So that's the way I've dismantled it. But I always try and see, you know, the reason in other people's points of view, and I could see how somebody could get to love and fear.
So what I hear you saying is that love is an emotion on one end of the spectrum. The other things, the four that you mentioned and possibly other things, are on the other side. And if you were to be able to get to where you're only a loving being, then you would be a happier, joyous, more being.
I Let me give a really quick background on those other four emotions. And this isn't my theory, I have to say it, I've read it. And so the idea is that all of those key emotions come from a very primitive space of survival. Fear, we're running from the tiger or the rattlesnake. Anger, somebody stole our infant child, we want to protect it, right? Disgust, I ate a bad berry and I must vomit it so that I don't die. Sadness, I just had a baby and it was born, you know, it was a stillbirth, I'm grieving. Joy, I see baby smiling at me, I'm smiling back at it, I will take care of it. So again, all very survival oriented. So that piece aside, then if we move to your question about being in that state of joy, if we could just cultivate and be in that space all the time, I almost wonder, I understand, and that seems to me to be a very, you know, Buddhist Zen way of looking at things, and I like that, right? But I also think that if I say that, if I go to that polarizing state and say, oh, let's all strive just to be joyful, just to be, then what happens for many people is that they then think, oh, I shouldn't be angry. I shouldn't be sad. I shouldn't feel upset when this happens. And I actually believe in anger. I believe in sadness. I believe in the other emotions. Why? Because I think that they're there to inform us. We don't want to hold on to them. We don't want to stay angry. It's toxic for us. We don't want to stay frightened. It's unhealthy for us. So to be able to feel one's emotions, not get them stuck, which is often what's happening, as you know, in addiction, but to be able to feel the emotion, notice the emotion, process the emotion, process the thoughts, and then let it move out of you. And I think ultimately that does bring us back to that joyful state, but many people come in fact, I was working with someone yesterday who said, I'm so afraid of conflict. I'm so afraid of conflict in my life. And he's afraid to, you know, talk over things with his wife, even if his wife says hurtful things about him or his, you know, little daughters. And so there's that part where he's feeling very angry, actually very resentful. And so but he didn't want to give himself permission to feel those feelings because he was afraid he would get angry at her and she at him. Where instead being able to process those feelings and then be able to go home to his beloved and say, honey, I feel so hurt when you talk to me that way. And I feel so sad when this happens. This is what would feel better to me. And so I think we can learn when to utilize our emotions in very healthy ways. We don't need to be afraid of them. We can just use them. And then when possible, return to that state of joy.
We don't have but a short time today on the air. But you can go to Carla's book, Joy from Fear, and get a larger explanation of anything that you hear today. Carla, where can they get your book?
You can find my book online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. You can also request it from your local bookstore. And it's also on Audible, so I'm excited for that. For people who like to listen to their books, it is available on Audible. The publisher is Familius, and it's out next Monday, so you can pre-order it right now.
You mean I got my copy before it actually came out? That's great.
Oh, you did get your copy. You got a preview copy, and those were sent out by the publisher, so absolutely. And it also can be, if you want to find a link through my website, you can also just go to drcarlamanley.com and you'll find a link to Joy from Fear.
So what are they going to see or experience or learn if they go over to your website? What's the benefit of somebody going to your website?
I think one of the first things is I'm an avid writer. And I write from a place of the heart. So somebody who goes to my website can find lots of free articles, lots of free resources. They can also, if they're a fan of meditation, they can do meditation with me free of charge by finding me on YouTube. I even have a tiny little yoga video there for people who like to do a moving meditation, so to speak. And so I think if somebody goes to my website, I'm all about, which is one of the reasons I wrote Joy from Fear. Many people tell me they can't afford therapy. And I wanted to do something where I could make a book available for under $20 that somebody could use, whether they're working with a therapist or working with a group or they're skilled enough to do self-work, you know, use it as a book on their own. That book is so rich when in self-help with very specific tools, guidance, steps, excellent case studies that will help people not feel alone. And so for somebody, I don't want people to ever feel like they can't afford therapy. It doesn't feel good to feel alone or isolated or stigmatized. And that's my whole goal in life, is to help people, whether they look at my website and go, oh, she gets me. I don't feel alone. To me, that's success.
So since you said that, let me say this. In the world of addiction, there are many people out there with different motivations for being therapist or having a treatment program or whatever. One of them, unfortunately, is making money. And my program, which you can get on Amazon, the program's called Freedom from Addiction 3, I reduced the price of my book from $20 to $12 so that more people could afford it. But it has better success rate and can be done at home. Everything is in that book that you need than an $80,000 28-day therapy program. So it's just common sense. If you can get better results and spend $12, why spend $80,000? And you're saying the same thing. I just wanted to let people know that there is a way out there for anyone who has an addictive behavior and wants to get rid of it but hasn't been able to figure out how to do it yet, to do it for $12. And
absolutely.
That makes
absolutely.
Me happy. Yeah. Another thing that I want to say is people all the time when I tell them that I cure people's addictive problems, they say, oh, you work with alcoholics, drug addicts, and smokers. Well, yeah, I work with those people, but they're not anywhere near the most prominent addicts in the country. And I would say that based on statistics that I have, that the most common addiction in America today is screen addiction. People are addicted to their cell phones, their video games, their televisions, and people are spending 4 to 5 hours a day in this addiction, and they're not being able to do other things, or they're falling into holes or hitting other people with their cars or whatever. So don't feel like that you got to be a drug addict to say, yes, I've got a problem with addiction, because I see over 30 different kinds of addictive behaviors, and they're all the same. They all come from the same place. They all can be treated the same way, and they all have the same success statistics. So I just wanted to throw that in while I was at it.
I agree with you. I cover that in my book. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Technology is not good or bad. It is our use of it.
Yeah.
And our overuse and our misuse. So I agree with you. It's been a joy talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Carla, it's been a joy talking with you, too. And thanks very much. And we'll see you sometime in the future, hopefully.
Yes. Take good care. And thanks again for having me.